start. So I would like to start with a like very basic question, the one you saw on the previous slide. How secure is quantum key distribution? And to answer this question, we clearly have to understand what actually security means. And the most basic thing to understand is what is actually a secure key. And maybe I should make my talk a little bit controversial and say that if you look at the literature and look at the definitions of security, then actually these notions of security are not sufficient for practical purposes. And that is maybe one of the main messages of this talk. So that's how I can make it controversial. So how to define security? In the a very obvious security definition is the one here, namely to say that a key, and under a key, I just with a key understand just a uniformly distributed bit string, and usually I'll think about n bits. And I say that such a key is secure, or one could say that it's a secure relative to an adversary E, if E just has no information on the key. Or in other words, if the thing that the adversary sees are just completely independent of the value of the key. Unfortunately, such a this definition is clearly very strong and is certainly also sufficient. It's the strongest thing we can imagine. But unfortunately, we cannot actually achieve it. So there's if you do quantum key distribution, you will never get a perfectly secure key. What you will get is something slightly weaker, namely a thing which I call here epsilon secure key. And it's just a key such that the adversary, E, has almost no information on the key. So that sounds very vague. And actually, such a definition, to make it precise, we have to answer certain questions. For example, we have to answer the question, how do we measure the information that the adversary E still has on the key? So we're saying this information is small, but how do we measure it? The other question is, how do we choose the bound of the key? So we are bounding this information, but how should we choose the epsilon? Is it sufficient to take an epsilon which looks very small, or should it maybe be parameterized by the length of the key? And actually we will see that depending on the information measure, this is, might not be sufficient, even though the number actually looks very good. So in this talk, I will actually answer this question. So I will tell you how we can measure the information in such a way that it actually makes sense, and how we have to choose the epsilon. And then maybe the more constructive thing is actually to say how we can now achieve such a key, because such a security definition only makes sense or is only useful if we also can generate keys which obey the definition. So just to start and to motivate the thing, we might have a look at the classical case. And in the classical case, we have, again, the key, and the key will always be classical also in the quantum case. So with quantum key distribution, we generate a classical key. But here in the classical case, I mean by classical that also the adversary is classical. So the information of an adversary is just modeled by some classical value set. And the whole situation key together with the adversary is just completely specified by a joint probability distribution between the key and the adversary's information. And now we can make things a little bit more precise. So perfect security now means that the key, or that this S is just independent of Z, as I said. And additionally, we require this S to be uniformly distributed. So formally, the requirement is just this one. The joint probability distribution should be of that form, where PU is uniform. Okay, now the epsilon thing. So one possibility to actually define epsilon security, and this is actually a very good solution, is to say that we call a key epsilon secure if we are still close to this situation we had on the previous slide. So we said that the perfect key just is equal to a key such a distribution is like that, and now we're just requiring the actual distribution of the real key to be close to this one. And the distance can be measured, or this is actually an important point, should be measured according to the statistical distance, or in quantum mechanics also called trace distance. which is defined like as the sum of the differences between the probabilities. So why is this a useful definition? Why didn't I take just another information measure, like the Shannon information or so? This is maybe more, the reason is actually this lemma here. So if I have an epsilon secure key, in, according to the previous definition, so a key which is such that the distribution is epsilon close to this perfect distribution, then there exists actually a perfect key, a perfectly secure key, such that the real key we have, the one which is epsilon secure, is equal to the perfect key except with probability epsilon. So this gives now a very well-defined interpretation to the epsilon. The epsilon is somehow just the probability by which the real key we have differs from some ideal key, which is somehow trivially secure, because the ideal key is completely independent of what the adversary has. And it also implies somehow sort of a composability. What I mean by that is that if you have some application, for example, a one-time pattern, which is secure if you use a secure key, then the application is still secure if you use this epsilon secure key, because the epsilon secure key is just equal to the perfect key, except with probability epsilon. So the parameter epsilon has now this interpretation. It's just somehow the failure probability. So if you want to sell a crypto system, you just tell the customer the epsilon is the probability by which the key he will get. Each time we'll generate the key, will have some failure probability, and this is epsilon. And this is now a very well-defined measure, which even has some meaning in a finite case. So we don't have to argue about something which is like exponentially small. We can really somehow give a concrete a fixed number, like saying the probability should be chosen like 2 to the minus 1,000. I mean, that's classical, and that's a definition which is sometimes used in classical probability or classical cryptography. Now, how does the situation look like in the quantum case? So the only difference here is that the state, or that actually the system that the adversary has might now be a quantum system, and this quantum system could be in some arbitrary state rho e, and this state might depend on the value of the key. So we have here this key and the quantum system. And one way to define security in this situation would just be to say that, somehow to take the classical definition and to say that, you say that this S is perfectly secure, so I will later give the approximate version, but it's perfectly secure if it's independent of anything that the adversary can get by measuring his quantum system. So whatever operation the adversary applies to the quantum system, he will always get something which is completely independent of the key. And this is clearly somehow equivalent to say that actually this quantum system is just completely independent of the key. And so obviously such a key is secure. So again, in this perfect case, we actually have a very clear definition, and there's no doubt that this definition is strong enough, because it just says that everything the adversary controls is just independent of the key. So the question is now, can we make this definition, or can we generalize it to the approximation case where we have epsilon security? Can we just, for example, say that a key S is epsilon secure towards Eve if the if it's epsilon secure for any measurement result he gets here? And to see whether this is possible or not, and the answer is actually it's not possible, we can consider a specific example. The example is actually a very simple one. It just looks maybe slightly complicated. So I just assume that I have a key consisting of n bits, and we assume that these bits are uniformly distributed and independent of each other. And now, additionally, I assume that the state that the adversary has just consists of encodings of single bits R, and the bits R are also uniformly distributed and independent of each other. So it's just an example of a state an adversary might have. But these bits R are now encoded where the basis, the encoding basis, is determined by the corresponding key. So the bit Ri is encoding, or R1 is encoded using a basis depending on the key bit 1. Let's say if the key bit is 0, we use the orthonormal or this like computational basis, also called rectilinear basis. And if the key bit is one, we use another basis, for example, a diagonal basis. Now, because these R's are just uniform bits, actually the state the adversary has is actually a fully mixed state. So it will actually not depend on the S1. So it looks as if the thing I write is just a complicated way of saying that what the adversary has is independent of the key. So the observation is really that this setting here, as described here, is just a state which is completely independent of the key. So obviously, this key will be secure relative to an adversary with this state here, because actually any measurement here, because the state is independent of the key, the measurement result will also be independent of the key. So whatever the adversary does, he will not get any information that gives him information about the key. So this is a very trivial example, and now I will slightly modify the example. I will now consider a key which consists of n plus 1 bits. And again, the key should be uniformly distributed. So this is a uniformly distributed n plus 1 bit string. But the n plus 1 bit, this time, should just be somehow correlated to the R's. Namely, the n plus 1 bit should just be the XOR of all these R's. So because the R's are randomly chosen, the Sn plus 1 will also be random and independent of those. But now, this state here will not be completely independent of the key anymore. Because, you see, the R's are somehow encoded into the state. However, if I now consider any fixed measurement here of this state, I will get some information which is almost independent of the key. This can actually easily be seen, because first, as in the previous example, the first n bits are completely independent of this R. So the set will not give any information about the first n bits. So it could possibly only give some information on the n plus 1 bit. However, the n plus 1 bit is somehow the encoding where we have used these S's as bases. But if we have any fixed measurement, it's very unlikely that the measurement will actually be in the right basis. So it's very unlikely that we can actually get here a value which gives us enough information about all the R's. Maybe we measure in some bases, and then we'll get the value of half of the R's, but we'll almost never get the full information on the R's, and actually we'll almost never then get the information about the X or about the R's. So this is just an intuitive explanation, but one can actually prove that whatever measurement you apply here, the set, this measurement outcome, will be almost independent of S. So in other words, the key S is epsilon secure relative to any measurement outcome. So whatever the adversary does, he will not learn much about the key. And it is actually bounded, this epsilon here is bounded by something which is exponentially small in the key size. And in particular, I mean, because it's almost independent, also any information measure like the Shannon information is small as well. And it has actually be proven by Benor, Horodecki, Leung, Myers, and Oppenheim that this is tight. So we cannot actually, the epsilon can also not be smaller than exponentially small in the key size. However, what does that tell us now? So we have actually now a key where the mutual information about anything the adversary can get is just extremely small. And I mentioned this thing here because that's the usual security definition you find in the literature. So keys are defined to be secure if this thing holds for any measurement. And now the problem is that actually there might still be a very strong correlation. Namely, if we know this n first key bits, we can just measure this state in the right way. So if it just somehow don't measure the state here until we know the key bits S1 to Sn, we will actually be in a position to measure this state here in the right way in order to get the information about all R's, and hence we will be able to reconstruct the bit Sn plus 1. And why is this a problem? This is a problem because actually, if we use the key in some cryptographic scheme, for example, we might use it in a one-time path. That's, by the way, the usual application of a key. It might happen that we actually learn parts of the key. I mean, not we, but the adversary might actually see parts of the key because he might know parts of the message, and then upon seeing the ciphertext, he can easily derive the parts of the key. So if the adversary just doesn't measure the state, but waits until she learns this key, it will be easy for her to actually determine an additional key bit. And this might exactly be a key bit she might be interested in order to determine some message. So I would like to make that a little bit more precise here. Next slide. So consider a quantum key distribution protocol. And the quantum key distribution protocol at some point generates a key, which is for Alice and Bob. But at the same time, the adversary might learn some information on the key. And clearly, this information should be very small. So, and one goal of the adversary usually, or this is usually considered as a goal of the adversary, is somehow to guess S or to get some information about the key. And now, clearly, if the mutual information between any measurement and S is small, the adversary will not be able to guess the value of the key. And this was the idea behind the standard security definitions, that if for any measurement this thing is small, then the adversary cannot guess the key, and then one somehow concluded that the key is therefore secure. But this is somehow only true if we consider quantum key distribution as a standalone application. If we now use this key in a one-time path encryption, the adversary doesn't have to measure at this point here after the generation of the key, so it just keeps the state. And now during this one-time path encryption, the adversary learns additional information. As I mentioned before, the adversary might somehow learn, let's say, n key bits, because he might know already n message bits. But he might be very interested in the n plus 1 message bit. But now the adversary can just use this additional information to measure this quantum state in the appropriate way in order to extract some useful information. And this is actually exactly what the example before told us. So we had an example where this mutual information was exponentially small. Yet if the adversary learns these key bits, he can extract additional key bits. And so in other words, this additional key bits will be completely insecure. So this means that this information measure is actually a very bad choice unless we make it extremely small, smaller than exponentially, or maybe exponentially small with a sufficiently large exponent. But if it's not as small, we have no guarantee that the key can be used in a one-time path. And this is clearly a problem because we usually want to use the key in a one-time path. And actually, I will also tell you later that it's impossible usually to make this mutual information exponentially small in the usual quantum key distribution schemes. So this definition will just not be sufficient for practical applications or for one-time paths. So what would be a more useful definition? So the idea is just to take this classical definition we had before and translate it to the quantum case. So we just somehow describe the quantum states in the same way as probability distributions, but it's now just like a large quantum state. So the idea is, because we have this quantum system here and we have the classical key, we have to describe the whole thing as a large quantum system. And clearly we can always describe a classical value or see a classical value as a quantum state or represented by a quantum state. So we just choose for any possible value of the key another state, and we need to have orthogonal states because the classical values are perfectly distinguishable. And then we can actually represent the situation by this state. So we sum just over all possible values of the key together with the corresponding state conditioned on this particular value of the key and with the appropriate weight. So usually that should be uniform, but it might be an arbitrary thing. And now the definition would just be to say that this state is now close to a state where the adversary's information is independent of the key and where the key is uniformly distributed. And this is just the same as saying that it's a mixed state. So this definition has been proposed roughly 2 years ago by Benor, Horodecki, Leung, Meyers and Oppenheim, and independently by myself and Robert König. And the definition now, I mean, the advantage of this definition is that it has the same interpretation as the classical definition. We can namely say that this key, if a key is epsilon secure according to this definition, then the key is actually equal to a perfect key, which is completely independent of what the adversary knows, except with some small probability epsilon. And this immediately implies that you can actually use the key in an arbitrary application, except with probability epsilon. Yes? Here I look at one specific case where I have some fixed parameters of the protocol. So in contrast maybe to most considerations in the literature, I'm just looking at here a non-asymptotic case. I have fixed parameters and they give me a fixed key of a fixed length. So
you can configure sometimes
that loss,
right?
Yeah, sometimes there's no key, but for each I can always define it that way. So that's a definition which is somehow independent of the length. It's just saying that given any alphabet of the key, so at some point I know how long the key will be, and then I just require that this key is uniformly distributed over its alphabet and independent of the adversary. Yes? Yeah. I mean, you can always somehow make the length of the key a variable and include it into the description. But this doesn't actually change anything conceptually. It's just, yeah, you can include any other information into the state that is around. But yeah, that, I mean, I know that, in, for example, in your definition, this is like formulated in these terms with the length. I think it's equivalent. I mean, as long as your definition is usually asymptotic, and I want to have a fixed one, because I have in mind that this quantum key distribution protocol will be a finite length. So any practical protocol has a finite length. So I want to have a finite definition for some fixed length. But I mean, that's only a question of formulation. Yeah, for quantum key distribution, if you argue about the whole scheme, I agree that then it's convenient to somehow have a variable key length. Yes. So the question now is clearly, can we now actually get such keys? I mean, it's clearly, obviously, a stronger definition, a strong one in the sense that we get perfect keys except with probability epsilon, but the question is, can we get them in reality? And the answer is yes, and it's actually extremely easy to get these keys. It's similar to Patrick's talk, we just do random things to get the right thing. So what I'm considering here is actually the case where we already have some partially secure data. And we have that, for example, if we run the quantum key distribution protocol. So if we first measure, if Alice measures her system, she will get some data which is partially secure. And the security will actually, or the somehow the knowledge the adversary will have will clearly depend on other parameters. And the important thing is that they can determine somehow the uncertainty the adversary has. But usually the problem in cryptography is you have some partially secure data and you want to transform them into a completely secure key. And I'm not speaking here about how to generate this partially secure data, because these are the other parts of quantum key distribution protocols. And the answer is actually the one maybe most of you know already. It's just we do some hashing thing. But the new thing here will be that we can actually do that in an optimal way. So what does that somehow... So this is actually the result which is known as privacy amplification, and it just says that if this initial value here is sufficiently random from Eve's point of view, so if the entropy given Eve's information is sufficiently large, and we do some hashing, and it's called two-universal hashing, I will explain what that means, then the key we will get will be epsilon secure according to the definition we had before. I will make that a little bit more precise. shortly, but let me comment on the history of this result. So this is actually a very old result compared to the age of the field. So it has first been found by Bennett, Brassard and Roberts in 88, and somehow independently in somehow in a different community by Pagliazzo, Zuleri and Luvi, and then later generalized by Bennett, Brassard, Kretor and Maurer. And this was for the classical case where Eve holds classical information. And recently we have generalized this result to the quantum case where Eve holds quantum information. This is the case you have in quantum key distribution, actually. So let me just quickly give some intuition how privacy amplification works. So the situation we have at the beginning can be seen as follows. So this is maybe, this might, think about this, these points here as possible values of x of the initial data. So x is the initial data, and each of these points is a possible value. Now the adversary has some knowledge, and knowledge, roughly speaking, means that certain values are not possible from her point of view. Clearly, in reality, they will all have weights, but think about this simpler situation where she knows whether a certain value is possible or not. And let's say that from Eve's point of view, only the red values are possible. So these are the values where, formally speaking, the probability is still positive given her information set. So this is the classical situation. And now, two universal hashing means that we just apply a random function. Let's actually think here about a function which just extracts one bit. So we map this x here to one bit, and the random function just is equivalent to a random partition of this set here. So doesn't look very random, but think about this red line just as a random partition of this set of values. And clearly, because we choose this partition at random, it's very likely that the number of red points here and the number of red points here will be roughly the same. But this means that given Eve's point of view, both values, both output values of F will have roughly the same probability. So that's the intuition behind privacy amplification in the classical case, at least. And quantum mechanically the same intuition might work, but one cannot think about these points clearly. So maybe the just a few words about this hashing. So what hash function should we use? We can just use any so-called two universal hash function, and two universal hash functions are just defined by a very simple property. It's actually as two universal set of functions, and we randomly choose a function from this set of functions. And this set of functions must have the property that if we fix two different inputs and we randomly choose one of these functions, it should be unlikely that the two inputs will be mapped to the same output. And so the collision should be unlikely. And if you think about it, if you just choose random a function at random from the set of all functions, you will, for example, have this property. So this is an example of such a function. But it's not very useful in practice, because usually Alice and Bob in a crypto scheme have both to apply this function. And if they just choose a random function, they have to actually transmit the description of the function through the classical channel. So this is why one actually wants to use smaller sets of functions. But another set, and this is actually just to show you that such functions are very efficient in practice. Another one is just the multiplication in some field. So it's roughly speaking, you choose some random string A and multiply it with the string X, and then you take the first n bits of the outcome. So that's clearly that can be done extremely efficiently, and so it's extremely efficient to compute this hash of the partially secure data. So this is now explains this first thing, what two universal hash functions are. So what does it mean to have sufficient entropy? And here I would like to go back to the classical case. So classically, the result that I mentioned, for example, the one by Bennett, Brassard, Kretor and Maurer, tells us that actually the size of the key bits we can extract is given by this entropy measure, which I call the mean entropy, and it's given by, roughly speaking, by the maximum conditional probability of X given set. And I should mention here that there are alternative definitions of almost equivalent measures. One of them is due to Yevgeny Dodis and Adam Smith. And there's a particular reason why I take this definition. And the reason is that I can easily generalize this definition to the quantum case. In the definition by Dodis and Smith, you just replace the set by an average. And you will actually get almost the same. But yeah, that's just in order to avoid confusion if you might have seen another measure here. But this is, the point is that this measure here is more or less tight. So you can actually say that the length of the key we can extract is given by this entropy here. And you can never extract more. Or also, so it means that it's also an upper bound, more or less. I mean, that needs to be made a little bit more precise, but it's roughly speaking this entropy measure. And now I can just, I have now a very similar slide, which is just the corresponding quantum case. And what I have to replace in the other slide is just this distribution will now be this quantum state that I mentioned before. So this distribution will now be the quantum state of X and E. Okay. And the mean entropy here is defined in the same way. So maybe the formula doesn't look very similar, but if you go back again to the other slide, what we have here is just a maximization of the conditional probability of X given Z. And I call the classical value Z and the quantum value E. So what we will have is just, again, a maximum, but instead of the probabilities, we will have the eigenvalues. So we will have the maximum eigenvalue of an operator which corresponds to this quotient here. So it's just this thing here. And as you can see here, we have just, again, the logarithm of the maximum eigenvalue. And because the things don't commute quantumly, we have to, instead of dividing, we have to divide first one half of it before the operator and one half of it afterwards. But it's essentially rho xe given by rho, divided by rho e. That's more or less what this formula tells us. So it looks a little bit funny that we can actually exactly use the same definition as before. And it's the result now, and this is the new result, is that two universal hashing gives a secure key which is essentially given by this measure here. And this is again tight. So we can not extract more key than this mean entropy. So actually the classical result exactly translates to the quantum result. So let me just make that a little bit more precise. So if you want to extract the key, let's say you have some data here, and the adversary might have some knowledge about this data. This is indicated by this X. So this is the amount of data we still can use, or the uncertainty. And now if we hash that to a key which is slightly smaller than this initial entropy we had, then this key will be secure, and the security will be given by this difference of the size. And because here we have a logarithm, it's sufficient to sacrifice a small number of bits. So we can sacrifice, let's say, 100 bits, and usually in quantum key distribution we generate keys of length 1 million or so. So we sacrifice a few hundred bits here, and we will get a security which is 2 to the minus 100. And because we have this interpretation, we know now that the key here will be equal to a perfect key except with this probability. So that's more or less the result. So just to conclude, I would like to remind some of the points. So this is maybe the main point, that there is a definition of epsilon security where the epsilon is well defined. So we know if we sell the product, if we sell a quantum key distribution scheme, we can exactly tell the customer what the epsilon means, and he can have some intuition for that. Namely, it's the failure probability. And I mean, clearly it's still hard to interpret probabilities, but at least it's very well defined. And everyone can decide for himself which probability he wants to tolerate. The other thing is that we can actually generate these keys, and but in order to do so, we have to do this two-universal hashing, and it's not known whether any other hashing technique generates such a key. At least, I don't know it. Maybe there are some results I don't know of, but I've not seen any other result showing that we can get epsilon secure except by two-universal hashing. So classically, we have other methods. We have the theory of extractors, and with an extractor, we can actually get classically secure keys. And there has been some recent results by Kempe and others who showed that not any classical extractor is good in the quantum world. So unlike this two-universal hashing, we cannot just take a classical hash function and use it in the quantum world. You really have to use this two-universal hashing. And then I emphasize this point because I see many papers on quantum key distribution where just some strange hash function is used without justification. And it's really the only thing we know of, or at least I know of. So just what are the implications of that to quantum key distribution? So the first is that the definition that is usually used is not sufficient, because if you use that definition, we are not able to use the key in the application. And with application, I mean the usual application, for example, the one-time path. So we have to use a stronger definition. And the other thing is that because this two-universal hash function, as on the previous slide, has this property that we can actually just choose ourselves what amount of somehow entropy we want to sacrifice for security, we could actually even leave this decision to the user and make it, I mean, the user could somehow choose whether he wants to have a longer key at the cost of reducing the security or not. And you can just easily adapt the security by choosing the epsilon or the length of the output of the hash function in a very well-defined way. Okay, so these are the main messages of this talk. Okay, that's all I have. Yes?
So in the previous talk, we have seen that John Wojcik mentioned that in the context of human knowledge protocols, sometimes, working with this instance is not good enough, and he wants to work with the diamond now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm wondering whether there is a situation in the security of key distribution in which diamond now is
This is a good question, but we are actually in a slightly different situation, because what we have at the end is somehow a static situation. So we have a key, and the adversary has some knowledge, whereas the diamond norm is useful if you have some dynamics, if you have some like quantum operation which we compare to each other. But the key is a static object, so it's just described by a state. And so we just somehow comparing the real key, which is a state and not a quantum operation, is the perfect key, which is again a state. And comparing states is, in that case, the trace norm is sufficient. I mean, there is no diamond norm for states.
So what I recall, John mentioned that if he can get some side information, then in that case, then this heat power might increase, and therefore
yes.
Diamond norm.
I mean, if you think about quantum, yeah. I mean, one way to think about it in quantum key distribution is to say that rho E that I have here usually is just this is actually the environment. So it includes everything, in particular the things that the adversary might have. But it's actually already, as Steffi said, it's everything. So there's no more quantum system to include. Adam, you had a remark? But you're right. If I somehow compared the protocol as a functionality with an ideal functionality, then for sure I have to take. I mean, then certainly the diamond norm has matters, because that's the only composable norm. But we are here comparing states, and that's the nice thing. I mean, and that's maybe also a thing I should mention here. I mean, to make the security definition, I don't need this general framework of security. And the reason why I don't need it, I mean, for example, this UC framework of Canetti, the reason why I don't need it is actually because I make here somehow the simplification that I assume that Alice and Bob, who are actually doing the protocol, are honest. And so there's no question of whether they cheat. So it's not like an oblivious transfer or so. So if I consider like oblivious transfer protocols or big commitment protocols, then I cannot define the security by just looking at the static situation. But in quantum key distribution, under the assumption that Alice and Bob are honest, and clearly if I compose the things, then I have to think about that, then it's clear. But if you think about it in a wider context where Alice and Bob might be dishonest, then I would have to define an ideal functionality. And the ideal functionality would actually be one where, for example, Alice can influence the key, because otherwise it would just be a coin flipping protocol, which you know is not possible. But so you can somehow rephrase these things in this UC framework, and then the ideal functionality would be a source that emits keys to Alice and Bob. But additionally, Alice has some functionality where she can actually influence the value of the key, or maybe Bob has that. And that would be the ideal functionality. So you can, if you want, rephrase that in this UC framework, and then you are speaking about quantum operations and all that. But, yeah. Yes? So this result here that actually this privacy amplification result is actually quite strong. You can actually take any security proofs and you just go in the security proof one step back. So go to the step before the privacy amplification, and then people usually compute somehow the either this mean entropy or the von Neumann entropy, which is, by the way, in the asymptotic case, the von Neumann entropy is somehow asymptotically equal to that. So all these results, at least all security proofs I know of, can actually be adapted to this security by just plugging in this privacy amplification result. So all the graphs they have seen by Hong Kong are certainly right also according to this definition, because you could just use this privacy amplification thing, which he, I guess, maybe already does. So, yeah.